Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, here we are with episode 10 of Digital Divination. Man, that's a milestone. That's our first milestone.
Suddenly we're at 10. It feels like we just kind of started this, but that's kind of a lot of stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah, when you look at podcasts and things, I think everybody gets really excited and the first couple are going okay. And then, after 3 or 4, people might start waning and stuff. But we've held on all the way to 10.
Hooray! We're established.
Yes. Well, we've got double digits.
That's right. And triple digits are on the way next. Now, this isn't Digital Divination isn't the only thing we're doing, right? Because you're also doing, we also have, obviously, our Intrepid Heroes game. But you're also doing interviews, right?
Right. Yeah. Those ones I've actually had quite a bit longer. Intrepid Heroes, we've published up to episode 40, but we've recorded up to 50. And then with presenting, I think I just did my 40th interview today, which was actually with Steve Jackson. It's funny. I was really pretty laid back about it because I heard he was a really nice guy. And then I got really nervous today after telling you about it yesterday. And then you're like saying, what, the Steve Jackson? He's like, he's gaming aristocracy. What are you talking about?
I'd be so nervous interviewing him.
Well, and so now I was. He was the nicest guy, and he would, he would answer anything I asked. But it was a lot different than most interviews I've done, because generally it's people that I have read a lot more of their work, or I know even personally that I've interviewed. And with Steve, I played some of his games back in the 80s and 90s, but I really don't know him at all.
Those games are just so foundational, right? That's why, that's why I'd be intimidated, right? Because somebody who was so active in early gaming must have sort of a lot to say or opine about the way gaming has gone or the way gaming hasn't gone. I'm excited to listen to this interview.
Well, I was thinking that too. And so I went in with my normal thing where, okay, here's some basic questions and I'll just let him go and tell stories. And he just kind of like answered the questions very concisely. And then I had to move on to the next one. So it's like, I'm scrambling around and, here's this thing that Ron said he wish he could ask him. I'll ask him that too.
He's probably been interviewed so many times by now, right? That it's sort of routine for him. And anyway, wants to make sure he gets, it's glad to hear that he's as good a guy as I've heard. So.
Yeah, he was very nice. And even, I had to reschedule the time a little bit because my kidney situation, I had to do labs this morning. So I said, I sold him, sent him our basic information for things. I said, is it okay if we push it back a little bit? He said, we can push it back all day. I cleared the whole day. It's all for you. I said, no, half hour's okay. Half hour's okay. But, he was very accommodating. He said he was wide open. He could do whatever. And so that was really, really nice. And it was kind of neat to talk about some of the things that they got going out. So folks should listen, look for that interview coming out. It'll be first week of September. By the time it gets published.
Great. All right. Well, I'll certainly be looking forward to it. Now, last time we talked, we'd sort of teased that we were going to talk about the Starship Operations Manual, but didn't. But yeah, we wanted to sort of respect the embargo on that, both for having the product actually being out and the No Direction Network wanting to sort of take sort of first crack at that as soon as they possibly could. I've done a lot of work on a lot of the Starfinder books, Adventures primarily, but some of the other books as well. But I did not even touch this one. This one was all you, John.
Well, I know why. There's no power armor in this one.
Oh, man, I do love me some power armor. I've taken a look at the mech part of the playtest, too. I'm with the sort of public sentiment that it's sort of excessively number heavy. But I haven't actually, put pen to paper in order to try to work that out or played that yet around the table. I think I really want to.
I think we could probably talk about that some next time. I had GM'd at Gen Con and actually had some nano sights in some of my games, and it was amazing. Flexibility the characters had. So I'm looking forward to chatting about that. But I need to dive in a little bit deeper, I think, as well on those.
Oh, okay. Well, let's do that. That's our homework, right? Between now and the next one of these. But yes. For now, we could talk about Starship Operations Manual.
Yeah, it's No Direction Beyond is giving it a really deep treatment because Alex and Vanessa and Owen were all really big players in this book. This being the last hardcover that Owen was in working on in terms of development before he left Paizo and then John Compton took over. What I wanted to talk a little bit about is kind of the process I went through to be able to write for this, because this is really my first job as a freelancer. And so to kind of explain to folks how that went for me and then touch on some of the parts I did here a little bit, kind of guidance I was given and then what I was able to do with that. And then in retrospect, looking at what changes were made a little bit, and what my thoughts are on that. That's kind of where I thought I would go with this. So this is not by any means a deep dive into the book, just kind of looking more at the process of creating some parts of it. How's that sound?
Oh, yeah. I think that's what people who want to, frankly, people who want to know more about the book, go buy the book, read the book. But people who want to know about kind of the background of the work of the freelancers that went into it, I think is something that you can speak to very, very well.
Yeah. So just to give a broader background on things, so there were two sets of freelancers that are authors that worked on this book. There was a main set that did a lot of big development, kind of some of the new rule sets, a lot of the new weapons, things like that. And then they brought in a second group, which I was a part of, to develop specific parts. And for my particular part, they asked me if I wanted to develop a couple of the companies that were making starships, and then four specific starships. And then later I was asked to actually take on two more. Now, how I got to that point, I'm really not quite sure, but there are two paths that I kind of went through for this. The first one is, I had been listening to an interview where John Compton was giving advice to freelancers. And one of the things he mentioned was, every time he plays a game with players, he will ask them about their background, what they do and things like that, in order to maybe find somebody who does something kind of interesting that would be good to bring in as a freelancer. And I was really feeling bummed because I had actually sat at a table with him a couple times and he'd ask about, tell us about yourself. And I thought he just wanted me to talk about my gaming experience or my character and stuff. I didn't realize he wanted to talk about all that other stuff. So at PaizoCon last year, I actually ran into him at the store right before everything got started. And I told him, I said, we met before. I kind of gave you this little bit of background, but then I heard in your interview that you really wanted this other kind of background. Is okay if I tell you a little bit more about me and my background? Because I think I have kind of a unique background compared to a lot of other folks. And he said, oh, sure. Yeah, that'd be great. And so I started telling him, and other people came around to talk with him, and I tried to horn in, and it was really nice because he actually kind of put them off so he could let me finish my entire story of things. so that was kind of neat. So I was able to get that. And so I thought, okay, this is great. Now maybe he'll contact me. Didn't hear anything for a long time. Well, then one of my players in my Actual Play podcast said, hey, is anybody interested in doing some work on a hardcover. And that was you, Ron Lundeen.
Yeah.
And of course, I raised my hand. And so I guess my name got in the hat that way as well. And it turns out that John Compton was the one developing this hardcover. He had taken over for Owen. And so somehow between the two of those, I got asked to get involved. And I still don't know which one mattered more, or if like even what I did before mattered at all.
I suspect that it is, because John is, I mean, by his very nature, he's a very diligent and precise person. So that's mm-hmm. your background is the kind of thing that he would remember, right? Mm-hmm. As being somebody mm-hmm. who's got real world ship experience, especially mm-hmm. for something that is about fantasy ships. So.
Right. Yeah. And it was interesting. So then seeing the group of authors that were brought in. So Paizo has a kind of an online place where we can all talk, and he can provide some guidance and, you know, different proprietary material that only we could access and things. And it was really neat seeing everybody else, because there were folks that were pretty regular contributors to hardcovers and APs and things like that, like Kate Baker and Jessica Catalan and stuff like that, that were also in this group with me. So I was like a little in awe of some of these other folks, a little nervous, you know.
No, you're good. I mean, everybody. I mean, but they were all at that point once too. Kate Baker was at that right. point once. Jessica Catalan, I was at that point once. Right? We're like, ooh, mm-hmm. I get to be among some big names, and you know.
So it was kind of neat. And the nice thing about it is, of all the folks, I seem to have the best grasp of the rules for starship building, having built and customized a bunch of starships for our various APs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so even though John had gone through and done a couple of, I called them starship jams, where he would go through the process for using the tools and creating them and the rules and things to look for, you know, it was something that was all kind of review for me. I was pretty confident in what to do, you know, so that worked out pretty well. I felt like I was kind of in a good spot. Mm-hmm. And so moving on to kind of the actual things I worked on, the guidelines they gave. So like for the companies, they gave the name of the companies. And so one of them was Ringworks, and the other one was Kevlari Collective, I think is what the name of that one was. Okay. Yeah, the Kevlari Collective. And so we had the names, and we kind of had what planets they were kind of based out of. So like the Kevlari Collective was out of, Castroville, and then Ringworks is out of Verses. Mm-hmm. Now, and that's about it, right? So I was able to kind of build out what those companies were all about, the approaches they took, where they actually located their facilities and things. And it was kind of nice, because what I ended up doing for all the stuff I developed is digging into all the existing lore about those areas, what they were like, some of the historical things that happened, and then kind of weaving that into those write-ups. So basically, I was able to extend lore in both cases about what the companies did, how they contributed to things, how the locations got affected and stuff like that, which was, I thought was kind of really cool. And for the most part, both of those were pretty much untouched from what I submitted to what ended up in the final book.
Well, that was building out history is something that's super valuable. So I imagine that the fact that you sort of took that on, like what happened in the history and how would it apply and affect this company history, and how does that sort of build on the depth of what's happened in our game world, is super valuable to have. We've run into some of that from time to time around the office. I know for when we were talking about doing an in-person PaizoCon, Jason Keeley, Joe Pacini, and I had kind of a historical Starfinder thing we were working on together, an event that never actually got off the ground. It can't be run except sort of in person, but we realized there's a real lack of specific historical details around a lot of stuff in our world, and that could be a lot more robust. So, I mean, it's not a surprise to me that if you took the reins of making that more robust, it was something that the developer seized on as a great addition to our canon.
Yeah, and that was something I was a little concerned about. And so one of the things I did in everything I wrote is if I mentioned something that was in canon, I put a comment saying this is currently canon, but this part here I'm adding, this is new that I'm adding, so that the developer didn't have to be 100% familiar with all the obscure history on things to know what is going to be new, what extensions I was making, because I didn't want to go too far afield, but I wanted to let them know I was pushing this in a certain direction.
Yeah, what you were building and where you were building it. That sort of comment. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of freelancers don't realize how valuable the comment function on Word is, frankly, to be able to tell your developer, hey, here's a thing that is brand new that I'm working on, or no, this actually is canon in such and such project. And I mean, that's very valuable information for us.
Yeah, somebody else had mentioned that to me about doing that. So I thought, oh, I should give that a shot. All right, and then they assigned me four ships, and I was given a company, a tier, and a type of ship. And so I was, the first one was a tier 1/2 tiny interceptor, and this one was made by the Kevlari Collective, which was one of the companies I was working on. The next one was a tier 1 tiny racer, which was made by Nebular, and I think this one had to have a hospital component or something like that to it. They basically wanted some sort of ambulance, and so I did that. And then I was given two high tier ships. One of them was a tier 16 battleship, a gargantuan battleship. And that was, I think that's all they gave me. They didn't give me a company or anything, so I got to choose on that. And then they gave me a tier 17 colossal dreadnought. So those were the first four. And then, which I was really excited about the big ones.
This was all in the first assignment.
Right, in the first assignment. Okay. And then, because somebody else was really busy with other internal projects, what it looks like, they gave me a tier 2 tiny fighter and a tier 14 gargantuan carrier that were both kind of related to the Allied Arms Corporation, a Triaxian company. So they already had the names of the things. They already had the company that made it. And I'll talk a little bit more afterwards, after I talk about the first ones, because these two had quite a bit of changes from what I submitted, but I suspect in part there were some things that were submitted by the previous author, and they combined my technical side with a lot of the narrative that was provided.
So, trying to match those things up. That's a lot of the developer's task, actually, is trying to match things between a couple of different authors. Mm-hmm.
So the first one I worked on was the K-51 Skyfisher. And basically, it was a tiny interceptor. And, you know, when I was working on these, it took me a while to get to this approach, but I finally decided I was going to look at existing aircraft or ships, like in the real world historically, as kind of a model for how, like, Jane's fighting ships described something and built it out and gave a historical context, because that was kind of the closest analogy I saw to what we were doing in Starfinder, is kind of giving, you know, some specifications, and then some historical perspective, and then some other things on it. And so that's exactly kind of what you see with Jane's. I don't know if you're familiar with Jane's fighting ships.
A little bit. I've had friends that are in sort of the wargaming years ago, and that was sort of their Bible, I guess.
Yeah.
Or sort of the historical documentation.
Yeah. When I was a kid growing up, I was really big time into military weapons and vehicles and aircraft and things like that. Part of it is my father was a photographer for the Navy, so we had all these cool pictures of all this stuff, and he was doing this stuff all the time. But I really got into a lot of specifications. So that was like the first thing I started looking at. And so this particular one, and the reason why it's a K-51 is I based it actually around loosely the P-51 Mustang.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. So basically, you know, a multi-purpose aircraft that was good at aerial combat, at close troop support, but was not carrier-based. You know, so that was kind of my initial thing. And so that, again, that became the idea here with this one. So I talked about some different iterations that it had. I talked about some historical things with it. Now, one of the guidelines that they wanted for us to do with all these starships was include something from the new type of weapons or the new type of materials or the new type of drives and things like that in each of the starships. So not just use the old starship rules, but incorporate some of the new ones as well.
Some of the new ones together to make the book seem more cohesive in that way too. Here's, right. We're giving you a bunch of new rules and here's a whole bunch of application of them. Okay.
Right. And because I'd already written up the Kevlari Collective, I said, okay, well, I'm going to base this one out of a Kevlari, or they told me, I don't remember which of the two, but somehow it got put in there. Because this was an interceptor, I decided speed and maneuverability was important. So one of the new type of engines were these Horkalom engines. So a new material that had exceptional performance and maneuverability, these new type of thrusters. And so I decided to kind of put that in here. So basically I built this out to have good maneuverability, really good speed. It wasn't heavily armored, had some decent weaponry. So a light laser cannon I envisioned for dogfights and whatnot. Then a light torpedo launcher I would imagine more for close ground support. So basically like a tank buster kind of thing, which is one of the things that P-51s were kind of known for. You know,
makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So in going from there, you know, a couple other things I put in here was the work that the K-51 had in the war with the Viscarium. So basically taking out Viscarium gun emplacements and things, and also against the swarm, taking out the swarm, kind of building those things in. And then the naming of this after the Castorvalian aerial ambush predator that we had encountered in Dead Suns when we played. So I figured, okay, this is a creature from there. Now, I just thought going with the name was good enough. And actually, whoever edited this afterwards did a really good job in incorporating the name in it as well, talking about how this originally had a sort of like cloaking device on it, but they took it off later because it didn't quite work as well as they would have liked. So they did a better job incorporating the name than I did on that. But for the most part, everything else kind of fit in with what I did. So that was kind of my process for doing the taking something kind of I knew existed, had a basic framework for how it worked, and then putting that into the context of what the Starfinders did or what Starfinder does.
Mm-hmm. In the history.
Right, in the history. So the second one I worked on was the Nebulor Sky Medic, which was a tier one.
The ambulance.
Right, a tiny racer. And so one of the things I had to do is take a tiny ship like this and somehow put a cargo bay in it or a med bay. So having to jury rig around the build points for that. And as basically something that was going to be an ambulance, I took out basically all the guns. So this would be something that purely relied on speed, maneuverability, being able to get there and get away, having some shields, but no weaponry, something that you would expect, you know, from an ambulance, right? It's not going to go in armed.
Right. And if it went into a war zone or something, you'd be able to say, oh, well, this is it's against the conventions of war to attack this ship. It's not, it can't even fight back. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that's one of the things that I mentioned is it had a very distinctive color pattern to signify that it was, you know, kind of a medical or humanitarian type of a vessel in here. And one of the things I wanted to do is, again, similar to what we see with aircraft now, I had multiple designators. So I had the first one, which was the NO-1A, and then later on there was the NO-1B and finally to the NO-1E. So different iterations that changed over time. And I talked about what happened in each of those iterations. Now, this thing I talked about first being developed based on one of the battles that happened with the Viscarium on Triax. So historically in canon, there's a battle that takes place on a mountaintop, the Battle of Alendra. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I mentioned is that there were so many casualties there because troops couldn't be evacuated that that led to the development of the Sky Medic.
Okay.
So, you know, basically using something in canon to drive this.
About that, why it even came into existence.
Right. Okay. Right. Why develop this when, you know, you could take a cargo ship or transport or shuttle and do the same thing? Well, we needed it because of this particular reason. Then from there, I kind of went on to, and this is one of the things I think is the coolest, is I brought the Sky Medic into the war with the Swarm, in that the Swarm attacked simultaneously in canon both the Pack Worlds and the Viscarium. And so one of the things I did is I said, so the Pack Worlds had developed the Sky Medic, and when the Swarm attacked, there were thousands of these employed to help bring back the wounded. And because the Swarm was attacking both sides, that Sky Medics were also evacuating folks from the Viscarium. And that this was a very critical part of building the peace between the two against a unified enemy. Because here was these new ambulances that were not discriminating against the former combatants, the former enemies that we had. You know, basically the peace didn't come until after the Swarm attacked. And so kind of building the Sky Medic playing what I thought was a really crucial role, mm-hmm. in building the trust with the Viscarium. Because when you look at like the Vesk, one of the things they're really big at is honor. Right. So if you have somebody come in and do something like that for you, well, you're not going to turn around and beat them up all the time. So that kind of thing. So I thought that was really cool. And they kept all that in. So I was really happy with that. And then kind of at the end of that, after, you know, both the Swarm War ended, you know, obviously the war with the Viscarium ended, you had all these Sky Medics now, and talked about a further kind of iteration of these where people took them and retrofitted them as Sky Lifts, where they would use them for, because they're highly maneuverable, they had a small cargo bay, for VIPs or really valuable equipment and things that had to be transferred. Where I got this particular name, not the medic part, but mm-hmm. the Sky, was that Amanda Hammond had written in one of the APs another aircraft or starship by Nebular called, I think it was a Sky Hopper.
Okay.
And so I used a lot of the design for that and scaled it down into the Sky Medic. And so you kind of, if you saw, you know, a series of these starships together, you'd see the resemblance,
the thematic similarities, and the
right,
sky
right.
name, and yeah,
and typically, you know, again, if you look at, you know, actual aircraft lines, you'll see that, you know, is they'll have specialized aircraft of different sizes or ships of different sizes that borrow from each other in terms of different things,
and look like the same lines, the same way that you've right. got okay.
And have the same kind of same characteristics, you know, certain critical characteristics that they're really known for, and they'll carry throughout kind of the particular line and things like that.
Okay, neat. But these are the little ones, though. And right. you, oh man, you got bigger.
Yeah, and the bigger ones were actually more of a challenge. And so, like the first one I started working on was the battleship, and again, going back to, you know, history and thinking like in the U.S., what do we name our battleships after?
I'm thinking of the different states. The battleships are named after different states.
Right. So typically, historically, the big battleships were named after states. And so for me, I was figuring out, okay, how would you do that in the Pack Worlds? And you don't really want to do this in a way that's going to put off any particular world. So I made this a Galorian class battleship.
Okay.
So basically,
the missing world anyway.
Right. The missing world. But I thought that was kind of a neat, and I wasn't sure if that was going to stick because I thought, that's kind of a reach. But it was interesting because when I was in the office interviewing somebody else there, Joe Pacini was actually working on this, and he was talking about that. So I'm glad he kept it in there. So one of the things that you run into is because of the tier, that you're assigned, you're given a finite number of build points. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with a battleship, what do you think of? Lots of big guns, you know, lots of heavy armor.
And huge sides. It's got to be physically enormous, right?
Right. And so it's tough build point-wise to do that at Tier 16 to make this something that is so dominating, because you can't put, you know, you have all these arcs. You can't put a massive weapon on every single arc. Mm-hmm. And so I had to kind of think back about, you know, what's the purpose of the battleship? You know, what did we want it to do? And here, so when you look at what battleships do with a group, like you'll have a battle group, typically it's the command and control ship. Mm-hmm. It is the core. Like you might have a carrier group where the carriers like that, or before when you didn't have a lot of carriers, you'd have a battleship is kind of that. And so one of the things that was really important for the battleship is not only being able to project a lot of power, but was also survivability. And so one of the things that I decided to do is I'll have a big gun. So I put a really, really big gun on this thing so it could do a massive amount of damage. I put a bunch of smaller guns on it. But one of the things I did, and I noticed none of the authors did this with their ships, is I put point defense weapons on every single arc. Because one of the things that traditionally battleships and carriers would have difficulty with is it wasn't other big battleships, right? You know, you didn't have that much difficulty going toe to toe with a big battleship. It was the smaller aircraft, smaller torpedo boats, smaller planes launching torpedoes at you that would slowly whittle away at a large battleship. And so what I did is I put laser nets on all the arcs. I put EMP cannons throughout, basically ways to shut down enemies coming in, trying to do damage close quarters. And then it had larger weapons for taking out capital ships, for taking out large planetary-based targets and things like that.
And then you got a technological solution with all these laser nets and countermeasures to the actual real-world tendency where a big ship would be surrounded by lots of other little ships, and the little ships would have the job of, like, getting in the way and making sure enemy ships didn't get close to launch their torpedoes, et cetera. You know, real-world ships not having, you know, laser nets and the like. But if you've got one ship you're designing and can't be designing it to have, like, a whole, you know, fleet around it, right, that's helping to protect it, you're like, well, we need a technological solution. And it seems like these countermeasures are a great answer to that.
Well, and the countermeasures are designed to, you know, basically as the last line of defense after. So this would be designed to go with a large fleet still. Mm-hmm. But you'd have these outlying ships that are taking on things further out, because the countermeasure is typically only good within 5 hexes. So it's like the, you know, that final, you know, tactical nuke that gets through everybody else, this ship has to be able to deal with it, kind of thing. So that's okay. More was kind of my thinking. And again, you know, that was similar to what you would see in with the big battle groups as well. You know, so it wasn't trying to take out everybody else, but it's like all of those things that get through everybody else, they're going to take care of. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my approach to that. And again, it was because I was limited on build points. I first started putting big guns in all arcs because, you know, I grew up in Washington, and across the way from where I lived, the battleship Missouri was moored for years. You know, and you look at, you know, it's got 3 turrets with 18-inch guns on it. And it's like, you know, that's what I wanted to build. You can't do that. There's not enough build points. So,
right.
So you got to say, okay, well, I'll have one really big gun like that, a whole bunch of secondary guns, and some of these other things. Plus, you still have to have, you know, your built-in defenses, your armor, all your other communications things, your sensors and whatnot. So that's kind of the approach I did, is take one aspect of what a big battleship would have, you know, and have that on there, but try to incorporate some of the other ones as well. And then historically, you know, one of the things I wanted to build in is kind of an important role for this. And again, this was supposed to be a big and impressive kind of ship. And so one of the things I wanted it to do was have some history against going against maybe even bigger ships. And so when we played Den Suns, one of the things that we had to go against was a Blackwind Annihilator Ultronaut. So this was
the Empire of Bones.
Right. The Empire of Bones, and which was, you know, basically designed, you know, to take out anything. And so one of the things I said is, okay, you know what? Three of these battleships together were actually able to hold their own against one of those Ultronauts. You know,
okay.
So, you know, historically, this is, you know, yes, they're only tier 16 and whatnot, but this is how powerful they are that they could do that. And again, I put it in here. I wasn't sure if they were going to allow that kind of cross tie in, and it stayed in. So I was pretty excited about that.
Oh, that is neat. That's really neat.
And then the last big ship I did was a Colossal Dreadnought. And again, this is another one where I wanted, I just want to make lots and lots of big guns. And so I was able to put in some big guns again, and I was able to actually put in more because this was a tier 17 than the battleship. And again, as a dreadnought, this was something, this is designed to hold its own without a fleet around it. So this was kind of a different approach than with the battleship that would go with a battle group. So that's kind of the approach I took, something that would go out solo and take on things. And so here I put in some bigger guns, but I also put in quite a bit of point defense as well with the laser nets around to take care of things. In addition, so that's kind of the basics, and I used a lot of the same things I did for the battleship. I built them one right after the other. Now, here, I wanted to tie this into lore a little bit, and so I basically said that there was against the Aeon Throne, there's talk about the stewards and the steward fleets and things, and so I said that these ships and this particular one, the class is a Ringworks Peacebringer, because that's what the stewards are about, is like bringing peace in a sector, and that these acted as the stewards' flagships for the director when the director was out
in the field.
Mm-hmm. And talked about how that these were very important for dealing with a swarm, or actually even bringing one of these within a system would, you know, any little skirmishes going on quickly got shut down because these things could just wipe out, you know, any individual capital ship typically. Again, tying this back to the Viscarium, during the peace talks with the Viscarium, that the folks, the Viscarium officials, were given an up close tour of the Peacebringer class Ultronauts and their main batteries to see actually the destructive power that they had as well.
That the ship was, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was kind of my four basic ones. And I actually think they were pretty straightforward to do. I was given quite a bit of free reign. The smaller ships, the build points weren't really that big of an issue because, you know, typically on the smaller ships, you don't see a lot of heavy armor, a lot of big guns, or a lot of big shields. The big ships, you want to have all of that. And so getting that balance was actually much more challenging.
A bigger problem. Yeah, that's with the little ships, you're just limited on the size of stuff you can have, right? Your engines can only be so big. Your power core can only be so big. And a lot of those gloves come off in designing a big ship. And so you feel like you ought to throw in the kitchen sink, but can't because you run out of points so fast. Mm-hmm. Whew.
And then probably about 3 weeks after I had done my final deliverables of the other ones, which, you know, I made sure to make all the milestones on time and make sure everything was as long as it was supposed to be within. My word count was like within three words. I guess that was tighter than I had to make it. But because later
What was your?
My word count. I got it within three words of the request of word count for each of them.
Oh, that's nice. Okay.
Yeah. I later heard within 10% was okay. So
that's right. I tell people 5%, but you did great.
Yeah. So I turned them all in and that was great. And then I heard back 3 weeks later, I got a really short notice request if I could do two more ships, basically with about a week turnaround. And these were the Dyad, which was a tier 2 fighter, and its associated carrier, the Horde Master, which is a tier 14 gargantuan carrier. And so the art was already done for these. I didn't see it, but they kind of briefly described it. The name was already done. So there's a lot already done. And I think what they really wanted was a build out of the specs on them and then a little bit of a description. Mm-hmm. And so these were basically made by the Allied Arms Corporation of Triax. With the Dyad, it was pretty obvious to me that this was going to be a bonded pair, Riforian and Dragonkin.
Dragonkin, yep.
Right. You know, so basically building out that scenario in a two-seated fighter was what I had to do in here. Making it part of the Skyfire Legion's mercenary fleet, again, kind of going with the tracks and front there, and the fact that these Riforian Dragonkin pairs are very common in there. Talking about how they work with a Horde Master, how many would work, and I came up with 16, I think, because of the build point costs and the Horde Master and things like that. You know, when I think of carriers, you know, I'm thinking like in Star Wars, the big Star Destroyers, they have like thousands of these little TIE fighters, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, but when we're working with build points, I can't make that many shuttle bays or
right,
things like
right.
that.
Or fill them with, know, so, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so what's a reasonable number? What can we do with it? And so doing some math and figure out how much would fit in the space, I made these, just 16 of them. And rather than launching them out of hangar bays, which is what we often think of, I talked about, again, something you typically would see on carriers are catapult launchers.
To fling them away from the ship so they can get started, get going.
Right, but the nice thing about that is it takes up a lot smaller space. And again, I went to more like the Battlestar Galactica kind of mode, you know, when they were launching the ships, if you remember those.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a tube and you would shoot out. So I talked about having launch tubes for these in here, how they would kind of pepper on the Horde Master when they went out. I also talked about how these were used kind of after they got retired from the Legion, that they were still in high demand because basically you had a larger section in the rear that could be used for hauling stuff. But also that these were extremely maneuverable because of the bonded pairs, something that really other folks, when they flew it, couldn't do the same thing. So that's kind of where I went with that. And when they got this, they actually, the developer or somebody added some additional things on here, which I thought were all really good. For example, you know, with the Dragonkin, having a space for their weapons and stuff, or their hoard in a compartment there. And I thought, oh man, that is really awesome.
What a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I should have thought about that as well. And then also talking about how, oftentimes, people might, use these and still keep the Skyfire, painting on them to kind of scare other people, you know, away from attacking them, thinking that it might be a Skyfire Legion instead of, a retrofitted Dyad. Right. And again, I mentioned a little bit about that, but they really expanded on this, saying, oh, in the Skyfire Legion, if they catch you on that, they do something to you too. Because they don't like it when you do
that.
They
don't want other people taking their dice toys. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty good. And then at the same time I was developing the Horde Master, again, trying to figure out what to do with this to make it kind of unique. You have, you know, it's a tier 14, which means I had even fewer build points than the battleship. Mm-hmm. And so the, you know, when you look at carriers, they don't have a lot of big guns, but typically they have, you know, a lot of smaller weaponry to take care of the small fighters that are coming in, but they rely on their own fighters for the most part.
Right. They're not battleships, so they're not intended to be having the huge weaponry to take out their peers.
Right. But I wanted to do one thing that would be really cool. And so I put on the Horde Master, and I'm glad they kept this, a mega teleportation beam. So basically, it uses this kind of teleportation power to rend its enemies in half by teleporting part of it. And this is a pretty big gun. It is a 1d20 times 10. So a big range of damage I could do.
And super swingy in there, too.
Right. And again, it's a carrier. It's not designed for doing massive amounts of damage, but it could do some. But the most important thing I liked about this is if you have an enemy within 5 hexes, you can swap positions with them. And so
as a carrier, very useful.
Right. As a carrier, positioning and tactics are actually more paramount than damage dealing. And so that's what I wanted to have for this. And so that was kind of cool. Kind of how
that is neat. Oh, that is neat. And it incorporates kind of the magic for which Starfinder is really well known.
Right. And so that is kind of the last of the ships that I worked on. So, that's my relatively small part. I think it was like 4,000 or 5,000 words total for all of them.
Well, so. It's a real coup for you to have the developer go back and say, now that you've turned this in, can you do more? Because that means two things. First, it means that, you know, you're covering for somebody that didn't get something done. Either it wasn't ever assigned or the person that was assigned to it couldn't do it. But what it also means is your initial turnover was so clean that the developer could tell kind of at a glance, hey, this has been really well done. I could use this person for more work. I can tell just by looking at it that this is well done. And here is somebody who might be able to help me out of a jam. So that's always a very good sign if you're being picked pretty quickly to help write more parts of the same project. So yeah, that's great work for you.
Well, I'm hopeful. One of the things that John has been really good at is offering feedback, and he did offer to provide some written feedback if we wanted. So I did ask him for that, and I'm kind of awaiting that now because it's just when the book was released, he asked us that. And so I'm sure it's going to take him some time to get things together. So
get the whole thing. Yeah, we try to carve that out. It's always a real tension among us developers because there's more work to be developed, but we also want to make the freelancers that have done past work for us better by giving them good feedback, and carving out that time is important. So,
well, and at the first milestone, he actually provided some really good feedback and on some things, which I was very appreciative of, and did my best to incorporate all of it in there. And for the most part, it looks like my initial turnover for those things didn't have a lot of changes. So hopefully that's a good sign.
Yeah, very, very much so.
Whew. All right. So, any other parting thoughts on doing these sorts of starships and stuff? Or
One of the things that I think it says really well for you is that they're very technical. It's like building monsters, right? It's something that requires technical expertise to know the rules, but also some inventiveness to put some real flavor behind it. And you put a lot of flavor and research into the history of this as well as the build. And so that's going to put you in sort of the universe of people who can juggle flavor and mechanics very effectively. And those are the people we like to have sort of as part of our, you know, team of writers to get more done. So...
Well, I'm hoping, you know, if you hear of anything, you know, you can put my name in the hat.
I actually, to be honest, I put your name in the hat for something just earlier this morning. So,
oh, nice. Okay.
You may hear. Yeah. Well, okay. We'll see how that goes.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I appreciate it. All right. Enough of me talking. I realize I've been talking a long time now. We did get some questions, so I will. I'll say we'll at least cover maybe the first one of these.
Okay.
So Lydus asks, I am considering playing a brief Starfinder game in between Pathfinder campaigns. What do you recommend? And he's kind of asking, I don't know if this is jokingly or not, why should it be a soldier-only squad? And he's looking for something 5 to 10 sessions. So what are your thoughts?
I think that we are in, as a company, we're in desperate need of standalone Starfinder adventures that meet this length and this requirement. That said, I think that there are a couple of adventure path adventures that stand by themselves really well. The two that come to mind is the first one of Dead Sons, because it's very much here mm-hmm. is the situation, go out, explore this asteroid, bring this thing back. And once you've brought it back, you can kind of, even though that launches more adventure in the adventure path, you can make that a sort of a natural conclusion at the end. Mm-hmm. So that one book, the Incident at Absalom Station, I think fits that very well. I think the first of Against the Aeon Throne mm-hmm. also fits that very well, because it's sort of a standalone story of, hey, there's these colonists, they've gotten in some kind of trouble, save them from the trouble. And the adventure path then launches on with, here's what you found out about the people that had the settlers in trouble. But once you've rescued them, there's sort of a natural sort of end of that internal sort of story arc.
Yeah, and that's actually, Against the Aeon Throne is the one I thought of as well, especially for an all-soldier squad, because that first book, you could get by with an all-soldier squad.
you absolutely could, and in some cases, you'll be glad you've got it.
Yeah, I think Dead Sons, the incident at Absalom Station, there's enough other stuff you have to do that it would be challenging, I think,
if you only had soldiers.
Yeah,
there's a lot of sort of sneaky that you're expected to be doing. There's a lot of, yeah, I think you're probably right. I think that's probably makes Incident at Absalom Station maybe the second best choice to the Against the Aeon Throne.
Well, I think Incident at Absalom Station is a great first taste for Starfinder in general, but I do think it needs a more balanced group. And so that caveat, which I'm not sure if that's what he actually meant, but mm-hmm. that's what it looks like, having a soldier-only squad, I think makes that one would second choice compared to Against the Aeon Throne.
Well, and I think that it might be that if somebody's asking me, you know, soldier only or soldier and operative only, what they're saying is they want less magic in the mm-hmm, the thing, maybe.
Right.
So that could be. So that's why maybe Reach of Empire also works really well, because there is some magical themed sort of challenges to overcome, but there's nothing that's so overtly magical that you couldn't sort of explain it away as, hey, I want a very low magic story. Tell me something that's got a lot of technology.
Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about these books is basically there are 3 to 5 sessions to get through them. If you're really rushing, I think you could get through them in 3. I think 4 is a pretty comfortable place to be. And if you're taking your time and doing some role play and learning as you go along, I think 5 sessions is you could do all that.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that fits that length. That said, there's almost certainly some Starfinder Society scenarios that link together shorter scenarios in a longer arc. What do you think about those?
Yeah, there's, you know, in season 2 we had some really good arcs in there that would work out pretty well. I think one of the issues that it depends on the level they want to start at. You know, so, you know, if they're all brand new to Starfinder, then going with season 1 and starting with the commencement and then picking up a couple of some of the more fun 1 to 4 campaigns would probably give you the, you know, 4 or 5 sessions where you would do that. The First Mandate is a good one to go in there. Star Sugar Heart Love is another good one to do.
Big a favorite. Fan favorite for sure. Yeah.
Live Exploration Extreme is another fan favorite. I was fortunate enough to play that when John Compton was running it. So that was cool. So that would be one way, you know, kind of pick and choosing a couple of those if you're starting. If you're higher level, if you want to try something higher level, then and second season, there's actually quite a few that deal with the main protagonist that you have to go against. Starting with Pack World's Warriors, which is the very first one of that. And then it kind of jumps around in there, but some of the later ones, like, well, I can't remember all the numbers off. It basically kind of, the climax is actually in the special, the 300 multi-table special, where you actually finally capture the main protagonist. So there's a really strong story arc in there, but it's across, you know, levels 1 all the way to level 12. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot harder to take a new group in and do that, especially in 5 to 10 sessions.
Right, so. Exactly. That's a lot of sort of jumping. But for certain groups, they may enjoy that. They want to see, I want to see what this thing has to offer in sort of 12 levels of play, and we're willing to sort of, you know, rebuild or advance as needed. I don't know, maybe that'd work. But
well, we are up against our time now. So we'll have to put off further stuff till next time. I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination.